accession number 4768, room number 3.
Mr. Wentworth, reel 3. Could you describe exactly what the armoured cars that you were operating looked like and what they carried?
They were originally, as far as I can gather, a fleet of normal saloon cars, and I'm talking about the early ones, a fleet of Rolls-Royces belonging, as far as I can gather, to the Duke of Westminster. Now, I can only say I know that they went back to Lawrence of Arabia's time. I don't know whether you ever saw the film on Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes.
It was actually one of those cars used in that film. And he brought them from the Dardanelles. Now, please let me emphasize that this is hearsay on this Dardanelles business. But they were modified into armored cars, and they carried, when fully laden, weighed 5 ton, 1,500 weight, on a chassis that was made for a saloon, and very little reinforcement. There were one or two things underneath your toolbox to carry the weight of the tools. You carried 2 camel tanks, which were large, about the size of a large luggage case, full of water. I can't remember quite how many gallons. And then you carried chargals, which were canvas holders full of water. And water was a problem. You were allowed at some time, wherever we happened to be, but I've known the time when we were only allowed 1 mug of water per day. We weren't too fussy about shaving. I've gone back into camp with the growth out here. And filthy. You had arms of a Lewis ground machine gun, which was kept inside the car, a Vickers machine gun, which was in the turret, facing outside the turret, a rifle per man, and the crew consisted of 3, a car commander, a driver, and a gunner. The gunner and the car and the driver were interchangeable.
What ranks would there be?
ACs, LACs, car commanders were corporal and above. And your officers, of course, were car commanders. Underneath the what would be the cars running board, there were 2 ditching boards fastened underneath from here to that window. Some about 10 or 12 feet, one either side, for when you ditched, you put those under the wheels, and by God, you've got some ditching, believe me.
It was common, was it?
Common. You'd go actual deep in sand, and you were all day at that. That's how I got promoted to corporal eventually. You had a large tow chain on the back, outside the car, and a spare spring. You had a toolbox either side with certain spares. You had a beautiful kit of tools, all Rolls-Royce, and they were all laid out in the proper tray. You had a spare sump plate, which, as I say, we used to have problems with. There was a spare half shaft, and then, of course, you put a few rations in your toolbox. The toolbox served as a seat on either side. Your gunner and your car commander sat there while you were actually in motion.
What about the actual armour? Can you tell me about the actual armour?
Of the armoured car, actually thick steel plate. It really was thick.
About half an inch there?
Oh, well, no, I wouldn't say half an inch. Quarter of an inch, probably. But it was a two-man job to lift the side plate off to get at your engine. That's as near as a description as I can give you. What other equipment did we carry? That in the main was it.
So when you went on for one of these lengthy trips, the armoured car must have been absolutely full of
it was,
equipment.
And this was its fully laden 5-ton 1500 weight. There was no spare space, believe me, and the temperature inside there in the summer was really terrific. I've known it up to 132 inside an armoured car.
Could you do anything to keep the temperature down?
No, not a thing. Not a thing, other than when what bit of breeze you might get. Now, the view was about that width.
What, about 6 inches?
Not more than 6 inches. Now, if you were battened down for action, it was that, an inch, by about 9 inches. And that's all you got to peer through. So you took a lot of, providing it was in a fit state for the car command to be outside the car, you had to take notice of what he told you, because you just could not see a lot of it. You couldn't see sideways, that's for certain. I remember we were having what was supposed to be a battle with a camel corps, and the flight sergeant who was my car commander at this time, he was too late in telling me to stop, and I slewed down a steep bank as high as this room, straight over a straight edge, and tore my sump plate clean off. It wasn't my fault, I just could not stop.
So your view was only to the front, was it? Could you only see forward?
Forward, you couldn't see back. That was done by your car commander.
And he'd have his head sticking out, would he?
He'd be on this seat at the back. If there was a cupboard, a locker door at the top, but if he was, this was in action, and in actual fact, in Iraq, I never had any action, but this was all part of training, so we would have imaginary battles, probably, as I say, with a camel corps. 10 camels represented 400 men or something like that. It was all good fun, and it was our training. One thing we did carry, again, was 8 flags. Semaphore flags, in actual fact, size off, which I haven't mentioned. These flags, used in various ways, one single flag would mean stop if you were going, and meaning stop. All car commanders report to the leading car, to the CO. Form V formation. Form line abreast. All these used as either a single flag, or probably 2 flags, or probably 3 flags. And this is where the colour blindness came in. You've got to know the colour of those flags. The reason, let me go back on the pay differential, is that you had to know far more on armoured cars than you did as an ordinary driver. For one thing, there was a lot more to a Rolls-Royce engine than there was to, say, a Trojan engine. You'd got, there were twin ignitions, you'd got a magneto on one side and a coil on the other. Each cylinder had 2 sparking plugs, of course, one from each. It was a different carburetor altogether to what we'd been used to. There were all sorts of differences. You had to be able to use Morse code with flags, buzzers, not flags, buzzers and Aldous lamps, and semaphore with flags, up to a certain, I can't remember the speed, but you have to have the speed to pass your exams from the next classification. I think that has definitely covered all that we carried.
On one of these trips, to keep the tracks open, how many cars would go out?
6 armoured cars, 2 wireless tenders, which were, again, Rolls-Royce engines, probably 2 lorries to carry your blankets, your equipment, rations. We had an ice chest full of beer. I don't drink myself, but there was an ice chest on there. Some spares, if we couldn't get them all on the car, like the half shaft, that was probably in one of those vehicles. We had a jar of rum. We were allowed a rum issue in winter time. We generally used to save it, and the cook. We used to take a cook with us, incidentally. And he would make us a rum punch with rum and tin milk. And if I had two tots of that, I used to go around the tents telling Bible stories about Joseph and his coat of many colours. I couldn't take a drink, never could.
And did you ever visit the villages?
Oh, yes.
Around Mosul?
Yes.
What type of reception did you get from the villagers?
Quite good, quite good. I had no moans whatever. In fact, when I went back years later as an NCO, the little shops that used to serve us were now in Mosul. There was one I remember used to sell nuts and all this kind of thing, and dates and such like. And I'm walking along the street, and this was 1934 when I was first there, and I went back in 1940. Chap says, Wentworth, Saab. And I could have done what I liked with him. The hairdresser spotted me, and I got free haircuts. There was a canteen waller there who came behind me on a bicycle and said, Wentworth Saab. This is the sort of thing. They were. I never had any complaints. There were the rough types, of course. But there was none of this that I'd heard so much about that they spat at you. No, I never did come across that.
Were they Arabs or Kurds?
Arabs. And as I say, there was nothing outside. There was a cinema. But if it rained, you were drier outside. And if there was a sandstorm, you couldn't see the screen. That was all we had outside. Christmas time was a time that I didn't enjoy. To see that drink was something I... They started immediately one Christmas over, done with, and they would start paying in the equivalent of 10 shillings. It was dinars and fills. Ready for the next Christmas. Every airman paid that. And when they'd finished, those billets were decorated with all sorts of things. A milk bar, when you walked in, it was chalky water. I looked at it, but it was all, there was crates and crates and crates of beer. I could never understand how any one man could consume as much. And it was 6 days at Christmas holiday, and within 3 days, all that had gone, and they were going round the back door of the officer's mess to procure more. It was terrible. You couldn't find, there was two of us who were non-drinkers, and you couldn't find a place to sleep. They'd be sick on you and all sorts of things. They'd come in at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they were back up again at six, drinking. They would walk round there with glasses of flat beer that they'd carried round for a couple of days. Absolutely blotto. It didn't appeal to me, I'm afraid. The best Christmas I had was later, still out in Marne, actually, Transjordan, where there was a ruling made that no drink would be consumed before this Christmas lunch. Because, mind you, a Christmas lunch out there was something out of this world. You can go down the hotels and pay a fiver for that, and we got it for nothing, of course. But they were really beautiful Christmas dinners.
So, really, at Christmas, the station must have been inoperative, militarily speaking.
It was. There was a guard, consisting of probably four men and an NCO, but other than that, nothing happened but drink.
Did you have the Iraq levies there whilst you were in Iraq?
Did I?
Have the Iraq levies?
Yes. Not at Mosul. When I went back, not that I can remember at Mosul anyway, but when I went back to Habaniya, there was hundreds of them. Matter of fact, they took over our sergeant's mess, much to our annoyance. They were grand chaps, though. And my favourites out there, you know, were the Indians, the Sikhs.
Why was that?
Well, they were so spotlessly clean. They were very, very civil. I liked the Sikhs, no doubt about it. The Iraqi labourers have no complaints. And as far as firing practice, rifles, they were dead nuts.
You mean they were good?
Oh, they were wizards, no doubt about it. No, they were all right. Not that we had a lot to do with them until it came to the siege of Habaniya, and then Then they came into it.
We'll come on to Habaneer later.
Later on.
So how long were you at Mosul?
Three hot seasons. You didn't go by years. You went by hot seasons. Now, two was compulsory. 2 years. Two hot seasons. If you were medically fit, then you could sign on for a third. And there was very few airmen who didn't try to sign on for that third year. Such was the comradeship and the general feeling on that camp. They'd have we used to do air-to-firing, air-to-ground bombing and such like, a parade, and the CO, this Wing Commander Fiddermont, would announce, 30 Squadron won the air-firing competition yesterday. Tomorrow will be a public holiday. And this is the sort of chap he was. He'd give you a holiday, but when it came to work, nobody ever had to be pressed to do overtime for him. Another thing that happened while I was there was the, I think they called it the memorial service, anyway, it was for King George V. We'd had his Jubilee parade, and this was the, I think it was the memorial service. He had a parade. Now, he said, I do not like church parades. He liked people to go to church of their own free will, but he didn't like parades. Now, if this is a case where I've got to have one, when you are dismissed from this parade, I want you to go to your NCOs and tell him that you either you do or you don't want to go to church. And if I can get enough numbers, there will be no church parade. We will go to church of our own free will. Do you know, they couldn't get them all in the church. Chaps that had probably never bothered about church, they went because Wing Commander Fiddermont wanted them to go. They were outside, and you just couldn't get them in. This was Wing Commander Fiddermont. He really was marvellous.
Coming back to the armoured cars, did you, when you went out with them, did you have any cooperation with the aeroplanes? Could you contact the aeroplanes?
We could. Our main thing in those days, because we hadn't got radios or anything like that, was message picking up. You put two poles up with a string across the top, and you tied a message to it. An aircraft would come over, and he lowered a hook from the underside of his aircraft, and he flew low, and he picked up that piece of string with the message on it. Now, that's our way of getting in touch with aircraft.
Did it work?
Oh, it worked perfectly. We've had many, many messages picked up there. We used to do this as practice, of course, again, when we were back in camp. Now, they had a very, very nasty crash while I was there, involving armoured cars and very much involving me. Going back to Digby, where this pal of mine had volunteered with me for armoured cars, that chap I'd never left. I'd joined with him. I went to Uxbridge with him, Manston, Digby, Eastchurch, Mosul. We'd never left. We were really close pals. We'd been up on the firing range, and there was only two armoured cars taken up there. I was the driver of one of them. The CO came up. This is our section commander, not the station commander. And he came just to see us started, and then he took off in an aircraft. Now, let me point out that these section commanders, as opposed to junior officers under him, were flying training officers. They'd been instructors, and they did a certain spell, and then they were sent on to armoured cars, more as a rest from this flying instructing. And they, in the main, I don't think there was any objection. They were all really clued up officers who went beyond asking advice of an LAC if necessary. Well, this they had to do so many hours flying just to keep them in touch. And this officer, he told us before he left, now I'm just going off and I want to take off in an aircraft, and he was visiting some close by. And he came over, and he'd done it dozens of times. He got into a dive, and he just gave us a dip, and away he went, and that we knew that was Flight Lieutenant Sandiford. But for some reason or other, he didn't pull out. Well, we've been firing at 200 yards, and these two armoured cars, I was driving the second one actually, were moving back from 200 to 300 firing range. Two chaps were dragging a tarpaulin, one at either corner, one of which was my pal, and he went the wrong way, so this aircraft wasn't going to pull out, and he ran straight into it. Well, he hit the first armoured car and he lost a wing. He came to mine and he lost another wing. If I hadn't been in an armoured car, I would not be relating this story to you, that is for sure. Anyway, it was a Wapiti aircraft, two-seater. And out of this wreckage, and it's a miracle, we'll never understand how, it was going up in flames, it was all in bits, and this chap walked out. He was an LAC who had been taken up by the flight lieutenant. He must have picked his feet up to get over the wreckage. How he saw it, I don't know. Anyway, we got him down, rolled him, and put the fire out, but he was shockingly burnt. His helmet, then I saw him years after, and where his helmet had saved him was all right, but they were all burnt and shocking to him. Well, then we looked inside and we could see the pilot still sat in his seat, dead, and he was still strapped in. And there's a third body. Well, this was remarkable, only a two-seater aircraft. We'd got one man out, we could see the other one, and yet there was a third one. And we had the eerie experience of having to fall in and call a roll to find out who it was, and it was my pal.
From the armoured car?
From the armoured car. It really shook me. It really did. There's gravestones, a photograph of the gravestones in there. It was a shocking deal. And he was a marvellous cricketer, this lad. And this was his to be. He'd been before we went up the range and drawn the cricket gear out of sports store for his first day at cricket, and he really was a good cricketer, no doubt about it, but he never made it.
So this was the worst accident that occurred, is that?
Out there it was, definitely. And I was, as I say, definitely was the worst that I was actually involved in the crash itself. Later, long after, in my services, I was responsible for salvaging crashed aircraft, but I didn't see the crash or anything. I had to get them out of a big hole, or responsible for organising it all.
Did there have to be an inquiry about this accident?
Oh yes, but we weren't involved. I did have to give a short account of what I saw, but not greatly involved. I don't know who would give it. Memories dimmed a little bit. I expect I did go to a court of inquiry, in fact. I remember one that I did was involved in, and that was with a vehicle, and the vehicle should never have gone out. I was having a rest from armoured cars and was driving a six-wheeler, and I knew before it went that the brakes weren't working. Well, I'd gone off the road. We used to get a wriggle on, mind you. An armoured car would be going up to, say, 60 mile an hour, heavy as it was, and the old lorries used to have to keep up with them, obviously. And I went on a concrete slip by down the roadside, if you can understand what I mean, and I couldn't get back, and there was a bridge in front of me, and eventually I just managed to get the wheels up this thing as I was doing the bridge. Well, it there was a spare wheel on the outside here, it caught that, it ripped the side of my vehicle out, and it was a right old do, and I did have to have a court of inquiry on that one. And later, and the snaps that I've given you even show the S-bends, and there was one I was going around, and there was a tree on the corner, which meant reversing to get round. And I had a fitter on with me, and we used to carry large chocks chained to the vehicle. So I said, right now, there's going to be problems here. You'll get that chock underneath as soon as I stop. I was carrying all the bedding. So I went forward and went out. This tree stopped me from going any further. I reversed, and suddenly the vehicle stopped and got the chock underneath. And so I pulled on again. When I got up the road, all the other cars were waiting for me. They said, you've got more guts than me, boy. I should have been out of that vehicle. So I said, what do you mean? I said, there's a chalk underneath. Ah, but he said, what you didn't know was that your rear wheels had gone over that chalk, the intermediate wheel stopped you, and down behind me was a drop. I think it had still been going. And I jokingly said, well, I said, I couldn't lose all your bedding, could I? I'd got to stick. But it shook me to think about it later.
So where did you go to after Mosul? But after you left Mosul, where did you go to?
I went to Palestine.
How did that come about?
That's normal posting from still on armoured cars. When you'd done your 3 years, you went to Palestine and you completed, could be, 5 years. In actual fact, I got away with 4 and a little bit. The ruling was that when you complete your CO on your camp in England, had to interview you 12 months before your service terminated to ask you if you wish to sign on. And so you had to spend 12 months, your last 12 months in England. Well, I was a bit later than some going out there, so I was a bit earlier than some coming back to get me 12 months in. But that was the system. There were still, again, 4 sections of armoured cars in Palestine, but where Iraq was based at 3 different stations, they were all, the headquarters of armoured cars in Palestine was at Ramleh. But there was always one section out at a village called Marn. It was way up in Transjordan, beyond Amman. And again, the idea was security. And one thing that we always did up there was our firing practice, annual firing practice. So we took all our ammunition up. The system was that one section completed 3 months at Marn. They left at 6 o'clock in the morning. The section that was relieving them left Ramleh at 6 o'clock in the morning. You met at Allenby Bridge, which is the crossing of the River Jordan. Now, it was pouring with rain on this particular morning. I was the one, or my section was the section that were going from Ramleh to Marn. So we signalled Marn. What was the weather like? Not too bad. They were leaving, so we left. And it poured, it rained something terrible till we got through Jerusalem. Then it stopped raining, and right down through the Jordan Valley, the story of the Good Samaritan round Jericho and all that way, and it was sultry, really sticky. Well, we got to Allenby Bridge, where we were supposed to meet and hand over officially, one relieving the other, and no sign of the other section. Well, we had our lunch, tiffin. We waited, and still no sign of them. One vehicle we'd sent on, it was a wireless tender loaded with all this ammunition, and it was a bit heavy, so we sent it on. And away we went eventually. We weren't going to wait any longer. I don't know how many miles it was away from Allenby Bridge, but not very far. And we came across this wireless tender in a snowdrift. And that's the piece of paper I told you about, snow in the desert. 3 different, complete different climates in a country that's noted for its heat, and there was snow. Well, several of us bogged down. Eventually we got moving, and we got to Amman, and still no sign of the other section. And what had happened to those, we eventually saw them 5 days later. The leading armoured car had bogged in worse conditions than ours, because we had had a route from Allenby Bridge to Amman. We'd had a reasonably hard track. They were coming through snow plus mud, and the leading car bogged. The second car decided, well, I'm not going to bog behind him, so he carried on, but he didn't get more than about 100 yards, and down he went. The third car did likewise, until the whole section was spread over a distance of about a mile, all bogged down to the axles, and they just could not get out. And it was so cold that one chap lost 2 toes through frostbite. It's just unbelievable. They dropped blankets and dry clothing, because they're in a shocking state apparently, and until we dropped rations they were living on chapatis supplied by Wogs, and they had a shocking life of it, there's no doubt about it. They were a sorry mess when they arrived. Of course, we had to wait probably 3 weeks or so before we could move on to Marne because of the conditions of the train. We eventually did, without a lot of problems, but one period we came to, there was a railway line up to our left, around a steep embankment, and the CO says, well, we can't get through that, so the only way is to get upon the railway track, which was a single track, and for me to train was just too bad. And of course, this is where my extra driving experience, Wentworth, up you go. Right, to get away back about 50 yards, get all the steam I could get up and up this embankment with 5 ton 1500 weight, mind, and at a given explicit moment, tear my wheel and travel along the railway line. Because if you went over the other side, you were in far bigger trouble than when you started. And so we travelled until the land appeared to be drier, and then we got back on there. As I said, we did the 3 months at Amman. At Marne. We had a Christmas up there, which was a wonderful Christmas, and this is the one I'm telling you about, where the NCO in charge says there will be no drink served till after dinner. This was midday dinner, lunch. So we went to Christmas dinner, and it was turkey and everything that went with it, and plum pudding. I think we were all pretty full. After the turkey, we thought, well, now it will be Christmas pudding. We wanted it. It was pork and all with that. And then we had Christmas pudding, and then we had trifle. I think we'll fit the bus by the time we'd finished. It really was a wonderful dinner.
Which year was this?
This was 1937. I arrived at Ramleh actually on Armistice Day 1936. So this would be 1937.